You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Oceans cover over 70% of the Earth's surface and are home to hundreds of thousands of species of plants and animals, but they're also home to increasing levels of chemicals and pollution. Joining me for a look at how that's threatening the health of the world are Dr. Susan Shaw, a marine toxicologist and the founder and director of the Marine Environmental Research Institute. She's been studying the effects of toxic chemicals on human and marine life for more than 30 years. And Fabien Cousteau, the grandson of Jacques Cousteau, he's an oceanographic explorer who's been raising awareness of the threats to our ocean's health through his films, books, and other projects. And I'm very pleased to welcome them both to our show today. Hello.
Good morning, Leonard.
Good morning.
Susan, in May 2010, you dove into the oil slick in the Gulf of Mexico that had been caused by the Deepwater Horizon explosion. What were you able to see once you were in the water that you couldn't see on a boat or the shore?
Well, I'm glad you asked that because most people think that I went down there and as a scientist and just plopped into the water. Actually, we went out about 40 miles from where the rig had exploded, and it was a month after. So there was heavy oil in the water, and it looked like it's something like brown pudding, and then the sprays come on top of that, and it sort of makes a white material. When I dove down there,
the sprays are the dispersants.
The chemical dispersants, the corrections. Mm-hmm.
So how deep does this thing go? You called it a web of death. Is it murky down for quite a while?
Well, Fabian and I were just talking about that. I did not have a hazmat suit, so I was completely covered, but it was actually pretty dangerous to go in. We did not dive very deeply and got out very quickly, I would say, because I saw what I was seeing is the oil, as you go down the water column, is breaking into tiny pieces, and as those pieces are broken up, they're releasing hydrocarbons. So at the surface level, it's a heavy smell of solvent. As you're going down, there's more and more hydrocarbon in the water. And coming from my perspective, I know what that means. These are cancer-causing chemicals.
And you clutched your chest. Were you afraid of getting sick?
I was very afraid. And as I actually, coming up, I was diving with a colleague, and we both got fiery sore throats and headaches that lasted about 3 days. And honestly, we were just, this is not nothing compared to the rescue workers who were exposed.
Well, how long were you in there?
I would say about half an hour.
How did the use of chemical dispersants make the BP oil spill an even greater threat to marine health?
What dispersants do, they contain solvents. They break up lipid membrane. So the job of the dispersant is to break up the membrane of the oil into tiny, tiny droplets. In the same way, it breaks into the lipid membrane of cells and organs. So anything or any person exposed is going to get more oil into the body. It becomes a carrier into the body.
Well, Fabien, the argument for using the dispersants is that the oil would just sit there, and they didn't want the oil to get into the marshland because then you can't get it out. But what is the alternative?
Well, I think, and Susan would probably know this much better than I, the mix of Corexit or dispersants and the crude are 10 times as toxic as just having the crude itself.
But it's if you just let the crude sit there,
well, sit there and
how long
either
does it sit there?
Break down at a regular natural pace, and in the meantime, of course, you have arguably a thicker mess that you can clean up more easily than trying to scuttle it all and break it into smaller droplets, which accelerates the process and, of course, creates not only anaerobic activity, but on top of which, we've got to remember that our skin is the largest organ. And with that in mind, it's more readily absorbs all these chemicals that we're talking about, which who knows what the end results are depending on how much exposure you have.
Now, I remember at the time that there were newspaper reports about the possibility of using some kind of bacteria that would break up the hydrocarbons. Are they ever used?
That was another one of the, I call these happy talk items.
Right.
And that was another piece of happy talk, was that the magic microbes would eat up all this oil once it was dispersed. In fact, what the dispersant did is sink the oil. If you remember, the plumes began to be identified, large plumes, miles long and high. And they were moving around, and finally, a lot of this oil got, it was sinking to the bottom. And once the oil got into the deep plumes, the microbes do not function very well in cold, deep water. So that was one of the fallacies we looked at. There were so many things. First, there were no plumes. That was one of the statements. No plumes.
Well, existed. Apparently there's no more oil either.
And the oil is gone.
It's magically gone.
The oil is gone. Right.
But, you know, one of the things that
I've got to keep... By the way, would it float off and disperse into the through the Gulf and into the Atlantic Ocean, or does it pretty much tend to stay where it has been spilled?
Well, you've got to remember, I mean, the Gulf is a big basin. And yes, there are currents that will take some of it away. But as Susan pointed out, a lot of it has sunk to the bottom. And in some cases, there are plumes that are still around. When you turbocharge something, such as these happy talk items, as Susan was mentioning, you also create this massive use of oxygen, and therefore resulting in an anaerobic activity, which kills off any of those bacteria and of course have other repercussions.
So it drops to the bottom, and there's plant and animal life at the bottom. Does it just kill it all?
It killed a great deal of the deep water corals. It's considered a coral graveyard. It's one of the tragedies. And people who dove in those areas found miles and miles of just completely mucky, dead, black-looking corals where there had been beautiful, colorful corals a year earlier. And I would say when the oil sinks to the bottom, on the seafloor, it works into the sediment, and there it becomes a reservoir. So it'll be there for decades, and it recycles through the food web and with storm activity, for example. So we've created a reservoir of toxicity on the bottom of the Gulf.
And what happens to the fish and the mammals that swim through this?
And that's the next step, which is it works its way into that food web that then concentrates in higher concentrations up to the point of the items that we consume as human beings. So it ends up in our plates. It ends up in our own systems.
Even right now, I should assume that anything I Gulf shrimp has a little bit of oil in it.
Well, if you see shrimp that have no eyes, that's usually a key indicator that there's a problem.
Really? It kills the eyes?
It creates mutations. So the shrimp are being born with, it's like a birth defect thing. But I also would say, when Fabian and I were down there, and this is, you have to consider, there's a time of high exposure when the oil rig is still gushing. And that went for months, and 87 days, in fact, until they could figure out how to plug it. But the exposure was intense during those months, and you have the fish that are they're the middle range of the fish of the trophic level that feed with their mouths open, gaping open, going right through to try to eat plankton, and they were some of those fish. There were massive fish kills, but the the other thing I think we saw, which was another tragic happening, was the dolphins. The dolphins have to come to the surface to breathe. And when the dispersants were being sprayed heavily, and there's heavy dispersed oil throughout the water column, they're coming to the surface to breathe through the blowhole, and there's no way that those dolphins would not have been heavily exposed. So I was working on the Strategic Sciences Working Group, the SSWG, that was a Department of Interior group of 14 scientists. And one of the things that we predicted was that the dolphins would die in hundreds, and they did. And, you know, half of those dolphins that died were newborns, which implies that the mothers were unable to carry to term. So you know, miscarrying animals. And this is just so tragic. It's beyond comprehension.
Well, you were there in 2010.
And those are just and those are just the short-term impacts. Those are the immediate things that you see, mm-hmm. not the things that you see further on down the road, which may be higher rates of cancer and so on and so forth. You and I were exposed to the Corexit and the crude in similar ways on a short term. You had gone diving, arguably, in the thicker stuff, so to speak, and we had gone diving a little bit closer to shore. And even then, it was horrible because being in wetsuits with a full face mask, you could still have the sensation of your eyes burning, your skin being very irritated, and having a shortness of breath.
Just because of the fumes, the gas fumes?
The gas fumes and being exposed to those little droplets. Now, imagine an animal that lives, that's their realm. That's their backyard.
And they drink that water. Our guests are Fabien Cousteau, the grandson of Jacques Cousteau, an oceanographic explorer, and Dr. Susan Shaw, a marine toxicologist and founder and director of the Marine Environmental Research Institute. Now, you were, Susan, in the Gulf in 2010. Have you been back?
I've been back many times. I have a project down there called Gulf Ecotox, looking at the patterns of these cancer-causing compounds called polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, and just hydrocarbons for short, or PAHs. So many of those are carcinogenic. So we're looking at, we got samples. We were lucky as scientists to get in during that high exposure period, and we got samples from what's called Ground Zero, which is around Grand Isle, Louisiana, and Barataria Bay. And those areas were heavily oiled and heavily dispersed. So we are studying the changes on those compounds over time to see, is the oil becoming more toxic? Is it breaking down to less toxic compounds? And we don't know the answer to that quite yet.
There are predictions that a third of the species in the oceans could be extinct within 30 years. Is that in the Gulf of Mexico or throughout the world's oceans?
That's throughout the world's oceans.
So we're seeing similar problems. When we dump things into the ocean, we don't always just dump oil. Are all those other things having an impact?
Yeah, well, it's one circulatory system. To take the big picture, the oceans are the circulatory system of all life that we know on this planet. And everything that happens in the oceans ends up happening to us. There's no such thing as a healthy people if there's not a healthy oceans. Whether you are right on the seashore being exposed to those kinds of chemicals because of our mistakes, or whether you're 1,000 miles away, if you eat ice cream, you're eating kelp. If you eat grains, such as cereals in the morning, or even meat, such as cows that feed on some of those grains, you're eating fish meal. You cannot get away from those kinds of impacts. We're all connected. And our very own circulatory system is part of that big circulatory system of the oceans.
So even if you live in the middle of the country, you're still going to be impacted by this.
Absolutely.
And I also get the sense that every chemical, whether it has anything to do with water or not, winds up in the oceans. Mm-hmm. How does that happen?
Well, even the chemicals that we now use in our everyday lives, this is about you and your world, really. And what Fabien just said is something we know, that oceans and humans are totally interconnected. But these chemicals that we use in furniture, for example, in the plastic of our televisions, our computers, and some of those are the flame retardant chemicals. We've been tracking those now, finding them in high, high levels in the tissues of marine animals.
And we're going to take a little break. When we come back, we'll find out how something that goes into a TV set winds up in our oceans and why flame retardants are in our oceans. After all, except for the Cuyahoga River, I don't know of any waters that actually burned. Maybe there are some others. My guests are Dr. Susan Shaw, marine toxicologist, Fabien Cousteau, an oceanographic explorer, and we are talking about the continuing dangers that our great bodies of water face. It looks like it's probably even going to get worse. I suspect that climate change will also have an impact. Mm-hmm. We'll come back to all of that after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Fabien Cousteau and Dr. Susan Shaw talking about all of the various things that are happening to our oceans. This can't be a new process, can it? In fact, aren't there natural oil spills in the oceans? Haven't they occurred since the beginning of time?
Absolutely. There's an oil spill every single day. And some of them are very small, some of them are natural. Many of them are man-made. And unless it's near a coast, unless it's near something that is affecting human beings, we never hear of it. The Gulf is just one example. It's one of the most poignant examples that has not only claimed human lives, but also animal lives.
You were here a while back to talk about the Amazon and the threats to the Amazon that we're seeing. What about the oil spill in the Gulf? Does it move back up the Mississippi, or does the Mississippi just bring a lot of other terrible stuff into the Gulf?
Well, the Mississippi's flow is obviously such a powerful flow. It actually goes out there. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the dead zone from all the chemicals and all the fertilizers and all that just flow down from the middle of the United States into the basin, into that Gulf of Mexico, it grows by about a mile or so in circumference every year. So this should definitely be a wake-up call. The Gulf of Mexico is one of the richest estuaries in the world, and yet we're treating it like an endless resource in a garbage can.
And it's been a source of food for this country, for Mexico, for people in Central America as well.
A source of income, a vital income for countless communities.
So how far do the dangers go? If I were in Belize, for example, or if I were in some other part much further south, closer to South America, would I all of this stuff be affecting the water there as well?
Fish don't have passports. You know those imaginary lines we draw on a map? Those don't exist in nature. Take, for example, the tsunami in Japan and all the news that was accumulated from all the debris, I guess mm-hmm. we'll call it, mm-hmm. That washed up on the west coast of the United States and Canada. I mean, that's just a prime example of how all these things are connected.
And how much is the radiation from that going to impact the Pacific Ocean?
Well, from the studies I've read and the news that we've seen, some of those fish are now have signs of radioactivity on the west coast of the United States that originated from the other side of the Pacific.
And it's not just these spills and radiation that are affecting the world's oceans. Fabien, you've spoken about the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. Have you sailed into it?
Well, yeah, there's a garbage patch in every ocean. The Pacific Garbage Patch, or the North Pacific Garbage Patch, is the one that has been getting a lot of attention lately, or at least some
attention. Because it's biggest, isn't it?
It's the largest one. It's about 150 miles off the California coast all the way to about 120 or 150 miles off of the Japanese coast. It's a very large area. Unfortunately, it's not always something that you can readily see.
And does it pose a threat to marine life in the same way as oil and oil dispersants do?
Hugely. Most plastics are in some way, shape, or form made with petrochemicals. And with that in mind, they're also built to last some 500 years or more or less. And the big problem is not the large pieces, which are a huge problem. It's when they photosynthesize and break down into smaller and smaller pieces and get absorbed into the food web and are impossible to clean up. But that's another one of those topics that I know Susan is very familiar with.
And if you want to continue on that before we get into flame retardants, which you mentioned earlier and I want to talk about. But so they break down. Fish eat them. Do they affect the plant life as well?
Well, what we're concerned about now are the microplastics that are in every ocean of the world, and they're being found along every coastline. And those are working their way into the food chain and indeed affecting DNA of fish. And there was just a recent study, it's kind of scary, in the UK showing that a third of the fish caught in the English Channel had these microbeads, the plastic microbeads, in their tissue. And then in Scotland, they found crabs, shrimp, all the way down to the small animals at the very bottom of the food web, the microbeads are present.
Well, what are microbeads?
They're tiny pieces of plastic that have broken down. They are also coming off of our when we wash fleece, for example, and they're also in personal care products. They're emulsifiers in personal care products.
I mean, if you look at simple examples such as we did an expedition to Kure, which is the last island. Last atoll in the Hawaiian chain, 1,200 miles from civilization. And you see 8 feet of marine debris, mostly plastics, washed up on shore. When you see the albatross chicks dying because the adults have regurgitated what they thought was food, when in actuality it's lighters, it's plastic army men, toothbrushes, and so on and so forth, into the chicks. When you stroll on a beach 1,000 miles from civilization on your honeymoon or what have you, and you scoop up some sand off that beach, you see those little tiny pieces of plastic.
Well, couldn't we just take ships with huge nets the way that we fish for other things and pick up all of this stuff?
Well, I've jokingly said that we could use that decommissioned fishing fleet and go out there and fish for the plastics, but the reality is much different, and it's much harder than such a simplistic approach.
Mm-hmm. And then where would we put it? All of these things are
exactly.
Coming. All of these things are coming from inland as well as the coast, aren't they?
Well, we dump over 1 million pounds of plastics in our oceans every single hour of every single day.
How are we doing that?
Well, everything from washing down the waste stream and of course, rivers such as the Mississippi, onto, of course, dumping these plastics, legally or not, into the oceans themselves.
My guests are Fabien Cousteau and Dr. Susan Shaw. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, Susan, you mentioned another kind of chemical you've investigated, flame retardants. How do they make their way from the products that they're used into the world's oceans?
Well, flame retardants are put into furniture and foam furniture particularly, and everything we use in our homes, textiles, carpets, and those products break down.
But so wouldn't they just wind up in dumps and landfills?
They are in landfills. That's considered a secondary source, a major source. And landfills leach. There's not one landfill that doesn't leach after 5 or 10 years. So in the leachate, we've been identifying these flame retardants. So going into surface waters and into the ocean.
And what kinds of chemicals are in these flame retardants?
These are halogenated chemicals, bromine, chlorine, fluorine. The ones we've been studying the most recently are the brominated flame retardants, polybrominated diphenyl ethers, PBDEs. The chemicals have been found to be persistent in the environment, bioaccumulative, and toxic to such an extent that we started banning them. Europe banned them much earlier than we did. And we have used so much more of them in America that Americans actually have 40 times higher levels in their tissues than Europeans or Asians.
Well, we want those flame retardants because we don't want our children's bedding to go up in flames.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that, actually, because, you know, if you'll indulge me for a minute, I'll give you a little anecdotal story from one of our expeditions where we documented orcas, which are the apex predator in the oceans. Nothing eats them. They eat everything. Very much our reflection on land. And with that in mind, we took the blood samples of some scientists that had been studying those orcas pods, especially the ones in the Pacific Northwest near human activity, and compared them to our expedition team's blood. And lo and behold, we had very similar amounts of those flame retardants and other toxic chemicals of which we're exposed to every single day, over 100,000 of them apparently.
So this is having an impact on whales as well?
It's absolutely having an impact on whales, spontaneous abortions, cancer rates are skyrocketing, learning and behavioral disabilities in our calves and so on and so forth. The same thing is happening with the child of one of our naturalists. Who was 4 years old at the time, who was tested as having 10 times the national average of flame retardants in his system.
And Susan, haven't you had your blood tested?
I have, and I have exactly the same patterns in my blood that I have found in the harbor seals along the Northwest Atlantic coast. And these chemicals, they're toxic in so many ways. They cause loss of IQ in children that are exposed early. They cause delayed pregnancy. This is in people. And the same thing, you see the same things in marine mammals, okay? You see, they're linked with autism. They're linked with diabetes, linked with obesity, endocrine disruption, hormone disturbances. So what I found with the harbor seal research, which we call sentinel species research, in the Atlantic coast, is that the levels are so high in their tissues that there's no way that they could possibly be normal animals. And in fact, when they strand and beach themselves up in these die-offs, which are recurring, they contain so many chemicals in their bodies that we label them hazardous waste.
Is this a bigger problem off the coast of the United States than in other parts of the world?
For the flame retardants, yes. We have the highest levels in the world, and the flame retardants are on every coastline. In every species of marine mammals, the levels are higher than in Europe or Asia. We've been studying this now. They were introduced in high volume in the early 80s, and now some of them, as I said, are starting to be banned. But I think with a big picture, we want to ask why and what can we do about this. So the why: do we have all these chemicals in our lives, in our oceans, in our food, in our bodies? Why? And it goes back to the weak federal law that we have. We do not control chemical exposure in the United States. People think the government is going to protect me from toxic exposure, and this is absolutely not true. We have a broken federal law, the Toxic Substance Control Act of 1976. It's woefully outdated. And now we are working very hard with the Senate to reform that law and bring these chemicals under some kind of better regulation. That's why, as Fabian said, we have about 100,000 in commerce, and very few of them have been tested.
Well, I assume that this attempt to change the law has met some resistance. Who's fighting it? Just the chemical companies?
Oh, absolutely.
Well, of course. There's always, you know, there's between the vested interest and the business as usual, which seems to be a much easier thing to do than change.
Well, I would think that alternative approaches could be developed, especially more natural ones.
Well, I would think that it breeds innovation, it breeds jobs, so on and so forth. But those arguments, of course, need to be adopted. And Leonard, you were saying, you had mentioned, bedding. Let's just take that as one example of how inundated we are. Your child is surrounded in one room with flame retardants, and that's just one type of chemical. Between the bedding, between the carpet that they crawl on, the curtains that are in their room, the particulate matter that is just floating in the air that they breathe, we have to understand that this is an extraordinarily difficult thing to deal with. But that one of the potential solutions, and first and foremost, is education. And this is what your show and others are doing.
Well, it seems as if a chemical exists somewhere in the world. At some point, it'll end up in our oceans. That's what you're saying. Do we know what's in many of these chemicals, or are those compounds proprietary information that belong to the companies that manufacture
them?
That's
a good question, because part of the regulation that we now have in place allows companies to market chemicals under trade secrets. So the many of the chemicals that are replacing the ones that were banned are becoming problematic. And I'll tell you a name of one of them that we're now finding in the tissues of seals is Firemaster 550. It took chemists in our universities about a year to figure out what was in that formulation, identify the chemicals in there. And as soon as we did identify the chemicals that are in Firemaster, we realized they're not less toxic than the chemicals they're replacing. So it's kind of a bit of a cat and mouse game. That's why now in the Senate, Frank Lautenberg has introduced the Safe Chemicals Act. And it's so important that people know about this and support that legislation. It's really, there's great hope with that. But everyone listening now should talk to their senators and their representatives, say, to indicate we really need this legislation.
Fabian, you grew up on your grandfather Jacques' ships. Can you see the changes over the years when you're out at sea, or they mainly visible below the water surface?
Well, I'd like to say just in my short lifetime. but in my lifetime and of course, in
three
generations.
You've spoken with
your
father, Jean-Michel, about them, I'm sure.
It's we compare notes all the time. And there's a concept called shifting baselines, which I won't get into right now. But just in my lifetime, I've seen a huge difference, mm-hmm. both above and below the surface of the oceans in terms of the health of that ecosystem. And there are places where I'd love to bring you that I can't anymore because there's nothing left. It's a sick or dead place.
You know, I had the pleasure, I guess I should call it pleasure, of being on a boat that went down Newtown Creek right here in the border between Brooklyn and Queens. And it was so scary looking. The surface was so scary looking that I said, there's no way I'm putting my hand into that water.
Wow.
And they said, don't do it. You know, they wear when they do a little test of what's in the water. They wear thick gloves to protect themselves. Well, it's kind of scary, and that's right here in the middle of New York City.
Well, it certainly should be a wake-up call and a warning sign. I feel almost like sometimes we walk around as zombies ignoring these problems. Look at the most recent news about that dolphin that unfortunately perished in the Gowanus Canal. The Gowanus Canal is now considered a toxic zone, thankfully, and hopefully will be cleaned up. But it just reminds me that we're living in our own filth mm-hmm. rather than taking care of it.
Now, you'll both be taking part in a panel discussion tonight. Susan, you'll be on the panel. Fabian, you'll be moderating the discussion. It's part of an event called I Heart Blue. What will you be talking about this evening?
Well, many of the things we're talking with you about, I would say we're talking about the crisis that's in the ocean now, what we can do about it, what some of the big problems are that people are not aware of. And I think I agree with Vivian that education is central. We have got now we're launching a campaign to deal with some of these problems called Stop Toxic Ocean Pollution. And the three pillars of it are research, education, and advocacy.
And we have more information about the event on our show page at WNYC.org. Just one more thing, Susan, before you go. One of your earliest collaborations was with the photographer Ansel Adams. And when I think of Ansel Adams, I do not think of oceans. I think of mountains and deserts.
That's right. I was actually a filmmaker. I have a master's degree in film. I switched my field, and I had gone back to Columbia, and I was a graduate student getting a degree in public health toxicology, and Ansel Adams contacted me and said, you have a dual background, we've got to write a book because photographers are being exposed to chemicals in the dark room, such as formaldehyde, platinum salts, mercury, and this is in the early 80s. The book Overexposure was published in 83, and that's one of his last projects. As you remember, he passed in April of 84. But anyway, that changed the way people were working with darkroom chemicals, but that was the way that it was the first time I got involved in more of an activist way, in addition to the academics.
Dr. Susan Shaw is a marine toxicologist, founder and director of the Marine Environmental Research Institute. She's been studying the effects of toxic chemicals on human and marine life for more than 30 years. And Fabien Cousteau, also a filmmaker, writer, and what else do you do? Well, you have all sorts of other projects. He is an oceanographic explorer, and it has been my great pleasure to have both of them on our show today.
Remember, education is the most important thing, but then we have to do something about it. And tonight we're going to share some of those potential solutions.